Okay, should be good.
All right. So welcome, everyone. This is the Aries Working Group call, the U.S. afternoon for the 31st of July, 2019. I'm Stephen Curran. I am hosting in place of Sam Curran, who is on vacation this week. As noted, this call is recorded. Recorders will be posted at the bottom of the page once we get finished. Start off with the normal Hyperledger antitrust policy. The policy is there in front as well. There's a link above that to the Hyperledger Code of Conduct. We expect all participants in this working group call to adhere to the Code of Conduct and to follow the antitrust policy. So both of those. Next up is the, you'll see in the guide, hopefully everyone sees my screen. You're seeing the attendees list. Please log in to the Hyperledger wiki, which means getting a Hyperledger Linux Foundation ID. You will be able to edit the page and add your name. We will start as we normally do with introductions. So the way we do this is an identity call, so we don't make anyone identify themselves if they don't want to, but please feel free to, if you're new, to let us know who you are, where you're from, and what you're working on, and what your interest is in working with the group. So is there anyone that wants to introduce themselves? Please do. We'll go right to left this time.
Sounds like somebody's talking, but it's really quiet.
That was not much of an introduction, Richard. Were you attempting to introduce yourself?
I just came off mute because I thought I heard somebody in the background, but it sounded really quiet.
I knew that. I was just messing with you. We need somebody to introduce themselves. Thought you could do it.
Yes, I'm Richard Esselin, product manager at Evernym, responsible for our contributions to the Hyperledger ecosystem, and I have introduced myself before and am happy to do it anytime people like. I enjoy meeting you.
Thank you, Richard. All right, those are welcomes and introduction. Any announcements? BCGov organization I'm with is doing a formal formally collaborating with groups on mobile agents. So there's an MOU that's out. There's a link in this to the MOU itself and a brief description. We're looking for completion by August 6th of the MOU so that work can begin. We're looking for fall, October, where we want to release mobile agents and people with verifiable credentials in the wild. So we're looking for that people to work with to get that started. So that's there. That's the only announcement we had today that I'm aware of. So does anyone else have any other announcements they want to let people know about? I'll give another brief nudge to see if there's someone else that wants to talk.
So, hi, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Carl DiClementi. I am the VP of Program Management here at Factum Inc. and just trying to understand what's going on in Aries and see how we might be able to play together with the interoperability story and, you know, benefit with some of the work that's going on at Hyperledger within our ecosystem as well.
And when you say the interoperability, is that the DIFF interoperability project you were talking about?
No. So I'm aware that right now the Aries work is only on the on indie ledgers, but I'd like to start to explore how we may be able to open it to the Factum network as well.
Ah, excellent. Okay. Excellent.
This is the right call for
all
you,
right.
But I'd also like to put a plug in for the morning call where we're working on the Ledger Resolver together. So that would be a good place for you to attend. But that's every other week.
Great. If you could send me any link or anything about that, I'd love to attend.
So, Richard, one quick question.
the ledger resolver. So you're saying that's now a multi-ledger resolver, is that right?
Well, we're talking about the architecture of what a multi-ledger resolver would look like specifically. So I can't say we've actually started it yet.
Got it.
If you look at the history of both, in the meeting history, you'll see both calls. And you can see Marcus Sabadello gave a presentation on his approach, which is fairly useful. I guess that was 2 weeks ago. And there's a couple other places where we've discussed it. You'll see that in the agenda history.
Yeah. No, cool. I asked partially because it was clear from a meeting I was at Microsoft yesterday that they want Ion they want to figure out, well, where does Ion fit? And it sounds like they should be directed to the same conversation.
Yep, definitely.
Correct. And my history was mostly for the gentleman to introduce himself. I'm sorry, I already forgot your name. But you might find that useful history as you look at how you want to interact with Aries.
Great, thank you.
Richard, just a quick clarification. So you're talking the Aries working group morning call, and that is just a thread that's going on in that one? Is that what you're...
Correct, so
is that the thought you're talking about?
How we take the Indie SDK and move it into, re-architect it to have the ledger resolver be its own thing,
right,
and work with a shared Aries library. And today's call, I'll just give you that now, talked about threading models. And so that was a spirited discussion, and people can see that recording. I got it posted.
Okay. Yeah. So that's the next topic. So threading model, is there any summary out of that, or was anything decided, or is the conversation going on still?
We spend most of the time educating each other on our respective concerns with the various proposals that have been presented. And I think we're going to have another call to discuss how we start resolving those concerns. Anybody else is welcome to pitch in if you have a different summary of that.
Another call to discuss the call.
The progress was made in that people understand a bit more now.
Yeah, I understand a lot more now. It was educational for me, if for no one else. I thought it was very valuable.
I saw some of the, I'm off this week as well, so I'm just coming in for this, but I was looking at I missed the call today, but I did see some of the follow-up chats on the Aries channel, and they sounded interesting. Sounds like lots of ideas are floating around without any sort of decision made, but lots of good ideas floating. It sounds, that's where it is right now.
Yeah,
right?
And we'll continue that conversation in pound Aries-SDK.
Okay. I saw it in Aries, I think, but was it in Aries SDK? Daniel Blue, you were on that call or on that discussion. Was it Aries or Aries SDK? Do you mind confirming?
I'm seeing right now it's an Aries-SDK. So I think there was some conversation,
excellent,
but yeah, mostly Aries SDK.
Thanks for clarifying that, Richard. Excellent. Okay. So we didn't have any other announcements. People can jump in again if they want to do that. Mike Lauder, are you on the call or somebody? Yeah, you are. You want to fill us in on any Ursa news in the last couple of days?
Just that we've started submitting PRs for Indies and OnCreds 2.0 primitives. So they're probably like half there. And so you'll continue to see PRs, and those will hopefully get merged over the next couple of weeks. And then all the primitives for Indies and OnCreds 2.0 will be in there. So Aries, how that concerns Aries is Aries is going to do zero knowledge proofs, they, at least the crypto primitives should be there soon.
Excellent. Richard, there was a call Monday morning. I think that was at Aries Maintainers or Indies Maintainer, Indie Maintainers.
That was the Indie Maintainer call. And the key summary is we're working on a release this week. Hopefully it'll be tomorrow. It might be Friday. And you can look at the release notes there. There's some improvements to the SDK around Livy CX not depending on an agency and around just close the window. But the transaction author agreement isn't is it doesn't correlate as much. We address the concern there. We fix some important bugs, but it's not as big a release as the recent ones. It's a lot of polish. So people can see the that did not get recorded. So you see the notes and release notes when the release comes out tomorrow. If you have any questions, contact me directly.
Okay. Sounds good. George, you want to mute? There we go. Thank you. Okay. Upcoming releases. We mentioned the indie release. It's coming up. Aries Cloud Agent Python. I was supposed to do, there's a little bit of checking I've done. So 0.3 release will be coming out in the next day or two. The main focus is a change to how the command line parameter system works. So this is where we shift from just a bundle of command line parameters to where there is a subcommand and then a set of parameters to that. So there'll be a wallet subcommand, there'll be a run subcommand, there will be a ledger subcommand, and then for each of those, there will be various parameters associated. And that is to make it easier to configure the agent for production use, that you don't have to, you can do certain things at startup, or sorry, at initialization, basically, of the production instance, and then don't have to pass as much information on the run command for example, spinning up containers when you've got the agent running in, Dockerized Kubernetes-type environments. So those are the main changes in there. You'll see those. There has been additional work on credential handling from the controller perspective. The controller is able to provide more detail, more information about how successful it was at receiving a credential and processing it. So that's for receiving a credential. The controller has more options to be able to tell the agent how successful it was at processing credential that was received. Daniel, you want to talk about the Aries Static Python agent release?
Okay.
Yeah, so not
question?
Too much to say about that. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No. You say you're going to release a new version. Is that going to show up on under master, or is it a tag, or
it'll be a tag. It'll be a tag, and then it'll go to PyPy. So okay. There's been two so far, 0.2 and 2.1. Both have tags in GitHub, and then there'll be a release to PyPy as well. And both of those are released to PyPy. Okay, go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, so not a lot to say about this update. It is mostly just minor improvements and stuff. If you're interested, you can follow the link there for the release notes. And that is likewise been tagged in the GitHub repository and released to PyPy as well. So there you go.
Excellent. Thank you. One thing to add is the general convention is that the 0.6 release is the considered complete. The 0.8 is considered API complete and down to bug fixes leading up to a 1.0. That's the model in Hyperledger, and that's kind of where we're aiming. So we're starting to have initial conversations in the Aries Cloud Agent Python, at least, and Daniel, you're probably having the same, which is what is going to be needed in the 0.6 release so that we sort of have a complete product leading towards 1.0. John, you want to give us an update on the SDK, Ruby SDK?
Sure. I was on the call this morning. there's the link to the current personal repository, and I'm in the process of moving it over to Aries SDK Ruby.
Excellent. That's cool. All right. Any other releases, work updates, things anyone wants to talk about before we move on to the agenda for this call? Preliminary is almost done. All right. Okay. Couple of topics. So basically what I did this week, Sam just sort of turned it over to me. So I picked a couple of topics, contacted a couple of people to check on to see if they can spend a little time talking. I grabbed basically two things. Tobias agreed to talk about OpenID Connect and the work he's doing there. And then I grabbed the priorities discussion that we wanted to have and sort of put together a little bit of a presentation related to that. So I'm going to talk about that after. After that, priority discussions will lead to what we want to talk about next, maybe the highest priority thing we discover. So that'll be the plan for getting to next week, and then we'll have open discussion. I'm not entirely sure how long that we need for that priorities discussion, so this may be a short call, but we also, I'll probably let conversations go down into little bits of somewhat into rabbit holes as we talk about particular RFCs. So be prepared if you want to talk about particular RFCs that you think are important and things like that. That's the type of discussion I want to have around the priorities so we can figure out the focus for the next while, particularly on these calls, but also as others start to work together and we collaborate on different things. So with that, Tobias, are you ready to talk about OpenID Connect?
Yep, sure.
Excellent. I will unshare. Are you going to share something?
Yep.
And yeah, I'll unshare?
I will share. Okay, let me know when you can see my screen.
We can see it.
Okay, fantastic. So this work, for those unfamiliar, is available. I'm on a feature branch of mine personally because I'm making some improvements, and I thought I would share that today. But for those unaware, this is a body of work associated to the COVID-19 opportunity that BC Gov put out. Would you mind putting a link in the chat for this, Stephen, so people can get to the repository? But so this is a paid engagement off the back of the COBITHUS opportunity that BC Gov put out. And what we've coined is what we call verifiable credential authentication via OpenID Connect, or this word sandwich or acronym sandwich, VC Authen, OIDC for short. And essentially what this is a way to extend an OpenID Connect provider to be able to do verifiable credential authentication. So the idea is that essentially, just to jump down, if you have any form of ordinary relying party, whether that be a existing OpenID Connect client, like a browser-based client, or a IAM solution, or any other solution that uses OpenID Connect today, you should be able to extend its profile of OpenID Connect to launch a modified version of an OpenID Connect authentication request to include this VC Authen type profile. And you should get back a standard OpenID Connect response that uses verifiable credentials as the authentication mechanism. So the authentication mechanism itself, essentially the OpenID Connect provider is a translator. It speaks OpenID Connect to other relying parties, and then it uses DIDCOM and verifiable credential presentation requests and presentations with an identity wallet or a holder in order to conduct the verifiable credential disclosure or presentation. The main way that we achieve this, essentially this sequence diagram talks about the different permutations around how the challenge can be generated either directly by the user agent. By user agent, I'm talking about the web browser, and to follow along with the OpenID Connect spec language. And then essentially there are a couple of branches inside this sequence diagram to talk about the different permutations. These two permutations talk to the different invocation methods that are present when you either invoke it, either when the identity wallet is either co-located with the user agent's browser, so you are browsing on a mobile phone and you want to invoke your identity wallet, and that will be achieved via deep links. Or the other method is I'm browsing on a desktop session and I need the intent of the presentation request to come from the desktop browser across the identity wallet on my mobile app, and I need to be able to respond to it. And then the browser session on my desktop needs to refresh and authenticate me into that session. And so these two permutations talk about the slight differences that are at play there. And then down here is just talking to the standard deviations you can have around the OAuth flow, whether that be implicit or authorization code flow based on different use cases. So I've noted a few different requirements. As I sort of stated before, the way we've tried to approach this is to create a standard OpenID Connect provider that extends VC Authn to provide VC Authn. The way we do that, for people who are familiar with authentication requests in OpenID Connect, you'll know that most authentication requests start with a authorize request to the OpenID Connect provider. You often provide the client ID and client secret of the relying party calling in. Usually you just include a scope of OpenID. However, we extend that to also include a scope of VC Authn. This signifies to the provider, if it supports this profile, to please use that. And this, the presence of this scope then alludes to the presence of this query parameter that must also be present in the request. And this presentation request configuration ID is an internal identifier to the OpenID Connect provider that allows it to resolve to how this relying party would like a user to be authenticated. I will talk about that a little bit more in a minute. And then the rest of the query parameters are standard OpenID Connect. So in regards to this presentation configuration ID, because we're using verifiable credentials and there are several different verifiable credentials issued from different issuers and could be in different combinations, the relying party needs to communicate to the OpenID Connect provider how it would like the OpenID Connect provider to challenge the identity wallet or the holder of credentials to authenticate. And this here communicates that intent. So this identifier identifies what is known as a presentation request configuration record that the OpenID Connect provider maintains. And this is essentially, for those familiar with Hyperledger Indy and their proof request structure, this looks very similar. And essentially you have a map of requested attributes where you name the attribute you would like the holder to disclose and any restrictions associated to that attribute. So what schema you would like it to be, which issue you would like it to have come from, the associated credential definition, and giving it a human-friendly name so that it presents in the proof request itself. The last piece of information you need to supply is this here, which is called a subject identifier, and I'll talk about that a little bit further on. But is there any questions as we go, or should I leave them until the end?
I have a kind of a basic question, Tobias. Who is supposed to be being trusted by the time this workflow is done? Is it the relying party who is saying, yes, I've engaged with this party who's trying to log in and seen the proof that I want, and now I'm asserting on my own authority some information that you should trust? Or is it the issuers of credentials that are held by the prover or what?
So the trust relationship's exactly the same as OpenID Connect. So when a relying party goes to an OpenID Connect provider and asks them to authenticate, it trusts that they are going to authenticate in the way the relying party has requested. So if I iterate to GitHub for authentication as an OpenID Connect provider. And they come back with an ID token signed by that provider. Then as a relying party, I am trusting that GitHub did actually sign a user in or go through some authentication mechanism. In this case, what the relying party is requesting is, hey, can you please do verifiable credential authentication in the following way to some user and browser right now? And when the OpenID Connect provider calls back with an ID token signed by it, it's the same trust relationship present. So you trust this OpenID Connect provider. It's the same trust relationship already present. Does that answer your question?
Yes. So just to confirm, if the OpenID provider, OpenID Connect provider, were to suddenly become malicious, it could assert things, and that would be a problem between the relying party and the provider. You know, but it doesn't.
So exactly right. So if it was compromised, just like any OpenID Connect provider, and the keys were compromised to sign identity tokens, and it could maliciously malform them. Yes.
Okay.
So this is designed for essentially you would run potentially in an enterprise scenario such as with BCGov, you would run an instance of this in a trusted environment. It would be a federated provider that you hold yourself. And yes, you would have a trust relationship between the integrating IAM solution such as KeyCloak and this OpenID Connect provider that supports VC Authent. Is there any other questions so far?
We've got a couple on chat that have come through. Ruben was asking about the alignment with the DitAuth work, and I know you connected, or I think you connected with the folks on Diff that have been talking DitAuth. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yep, absolutely. So Oliver and I sat down and chatted last week. Kyle set up a meeting, and that was really good. And so essentially, how DitAuth is working at the moment, to simplify the diagram, the relying party and the verifier collapse in that model. And so these two become the same thing. And what they do is they issue what is called SIOP, self-issued OpenID Connect tokens, to the holder directly in a request response pattern. And so SIOP takes the place of DIDCOM as the semantics layer for communicating the verifiable for communicating the authentication challenge. In our case, we're talking about a verifiable credential presentation request, but in the case of the DIDAuth working group definition, it's an authentication request. And so my thinking for using DIDCOM here instead of SIOP is I've looked at SIOP quite significantly, and I think there are some semantics that we are going to have to adhere to be OpenID Connect potentially compliant that I think are going to be more of a headache than they are worth. And my impression of SIOP at this stage, at least, is it's a corner of the OpenID Connect spec, and I'm not sure how much people have actually implemented it and how much benefit we will get by adhering to it versus using some semantics such as DIDCOM, which is readily built for DID infrastructure. Does anyone else have any commentary on their impression of SIOP to add to that conversation?
So, yeah, this is Drummond. I spent most of the day over with the Microsoft team yesterday on a number of topics related to, you know, DIDs and SSI and all this stuff. We did talk about this SIOP, I call it PSIOP, profile, and they are, you know, they're putting quite a bit of effort into hardening that, adapting it, because it does cover the case where the backend system does not have knowledge of all it understands is the OpenID tokens. So actually, I want to make sure I'm following this correctly. You were describing that, Tobias, as the RP and OP collapse. So you just got the DIDCOM going on with the wallet holder, and the OP basically is.
Yeah, that's correct. So in the SAOP profile, because I believe the reason that was the case is because in some instances with Uport, the calling JavaScript application running in browser actually directly generates a request and uses a messaging pub sub system to actually get the response back to the actual running browser client. The requester, the relying party application, actually becomes the verifiable credential verifier in that case, which is great for certain use cases. But when you have IAM solutions that only talk standard interfaces, that's not practical unless those standard interfaces talk SAOP, and I'm yet to see much evidence of that. So one of the other integrations we could have explored was KeyCloak using SAOP tokens out, but that would have required a lot more custom functionality, and plugging that into IAM solutions such as KeyCloak would be a lot harder. So we decided that a separate service presenting as a standard OpenID can provider for those sorts of IAM solutions was a better explanation. But I guess what I'm sort of pointing to is the Diff Interop project is kind of just talking about this piece of communication. So 1 and 4 are optional. You could use SAOP here, or you could use DIDCOM.
Right. So
Tobias, can I just, I want to challenge one thing you said. I think it's the right side of the diagram, but the thing that changes on the right side of the diagram is there's no DIDCOM in it.
Right. That's true.
SIOP replaces the DIDCOM.
Correct. Yes, correct. So SIOP becomes the semantics that secures the authentication, the request response challenge, whether that be a presentation request of verifiable credentials or just simply prove a DID that I know about.
Oh, but I think that it doesn't have a way to ask you for verifiable credentials. It only has you a way to ask for a DID.
Correct. Right. But I believe, based on some of the movements, I believe that some people are expecting to use SAOP for verifiable credential request and response and all sorts of other more advanced things. And so this is why I'm asking the question now, because I believe some players are intending to use SAOP for essentially all identity wallet to like all verifiable credential interactions or all interactions in this space. And I would rather use a standardized semantics that is kind of purpose built rather than the corner of a spec that perhaps isn't really that widely used anyway. I could be argued out of that view though.
Right. Okay. So this, I think Daniel and I are both coming at this from, I don't disagree with you, Tobias. I want to make sure you understand that DIDCOM is the future. And I don't know if I go so far as saying OIDC is the past, but let's just not get into that argument. What I definitely am hearing from certain parties is, hey, we've got OIDC infrastructure. We'd love to be able to talk to, they refer to them as DID wallets, right? Obviously Aries wallets, right? And so that configuration that I'm seeing is exactly the opposite of what you were saying, collapsing the left and the middle. It's collapsing the right and the middle. And the request from the RP is a standard request. And what happens is the OP, a standard OpenID request, the OP responds because it's got a DID wallet, because you've collapsed the DID wallet into it. It recognizes and says, oh, I can answer this by with one or more credentials or claims I have in the wallet. And it prepares the response under SIOP and returns it to the RP. So SIOP is the protocol ends up being the protocol on the left. Is that, do you have that?
That's totally right. So, but my impression is with SAOP is, although it builds upon the semantics of OpenID Connect, and I would agree with exactly with your assertion, OpenID Connect, very much not the past. And that's why I would love to explore integrations like this that that leverages all of the great work that's being done there. I guess what I'm talking about is when you're doing challenges with an identity wallets, SAOP may build upon the semantics of OpenID Connect, but in order to add SAOP, you do have to do quite a few things that are very different to OpenID Connect requests. And there is several aspects of that request that I am, especially if we steer down that path and then we decide that that's how credential exchange or verifiable credential requests, presentation requests should also be handled over SAOP, I'm worried that the semantics will carry through might prove more of a headache than they're worth. But as I said, happy to be convinced otherwise.
So I'm not as deeply involved, but from what I hear is that the OpenID Connect thing would be really just for the initial connection. It seems that there's a very broad support to do DITCOM for anything after the initial connection, if that makes sense. So I'm aware at least that the Uport team is also like very much looking into using DITCOM. So that seems to be not controversial. I think it's more, is it open like the SOIP thing as a initial, I know, handshake thing. But as I said, I'm not as deeply involved, so not the worst following up for them.
Okay.
Yeah, as we were whiteboarding it yesterday, because we came at the whole conversation from a different perspective, which was talking about agent-agent communications and then working backwards to OpenID compatibility with, you know, with existing systems, we ended up drawing fairly similar diagram, but realizing that basically one of them that you've described in here really is from a DITCOM and you know SSI architecture standpoint, you've got an edge agent and a cloud agent. The edge is on the far left, and the cloud's in the middle, and we realize you can do it either way. The relying party could be talking to a cloud agent that is going to talk to the edge and exactly what you've got here, or the relying party can talk directly to an edge agent in SIOP. And they're, you know, they both work. If all you've got involved is an edge agent, then the maximum sort of benefit you can get is from intelligence in the edge agent in the wallet that is going to, you know, provide an SIOP response. And because that's pretty limited anyway, I was not that concerned. It was like, oh yeah, if you want that for compatibility with OpenID systems, it's not that big a deal. It's a chunk of work, but it will just sort of, you know, slowly go away over time. If what you're talking about is, oh, they want to use SIOP as the overall protocol and just extend OpenID systems and start to understand, you know, verifiable claims and all the richness of DITCOM via shoehorning it to another protocol, I completely agree with you, Tobias. That does not make, but that's not the sense I got from the conversations at Microsoft. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm totally happy. I guess what I see with SAOP and DITCOM is they're just both a semantics layer over top of Jose for secured, basically, messaging. SAOP is a request response pattern. DITCOM's more flexible as an asynchronous messaging protocol. But essentially, yeah, they are kind of interchangeable. And so, yeah, if we are talking about potentially using SAOP at the boundary and the first authentication, we can. And then, yeah, I guess my resistance was more advanced exchanges between an identity wallet and a verifier. Forget this half for a second, just these two pieces.
Yeah.
I would argue that having a semantics layer purpose built for that interaction is a better path.
If there's anyone on this call that disagrees, just go away.
was there any other questions from the chat, Stephen?
No, those are the main ones. That's really the big the big issue people are wondering about, or and most particularly Drummond and Rubin, the people that are engaging here. Just as a matter of interest, and maybe you guys can answer, because I really don't know enough about SIOP. Does it, I mean, the big use case we want is to be able to have an IAM that has one option for users to be able to authenticate and be authorized is a using verifiable credentials. So today they're using, you know, Active Directory, maybe two Active Directory options, and maybe they can and use GitHub, for example. Those are their options right now, and we want to give them a third option so that we can fade out the first ones. Does that requirement change the SIOP discussion, or can SIOP just be handled just through configuration? Does that make sense?
Yeah, so my investigation of existing IAM solutions and how they work and how they plug in different methods of authentication is a lot of different IAM solutions allow the ability to standardize plugging in different OpenID Connect providers as a means of authentication. So, for example, KeyCloak, as a relying party, often reserves the authorization decision back there itself, but it may use GitHub or AD to do the authentication into a domain and still use the returned ID token to make an access control decision. And I wanted to synergize with that approach in this implementation and just create a standard service that could be put into those IAM solutions as a next mode of authentication. This is why I'm explicitly calling it authentication rather than authorization. It is just the authentication of a combination of credentials. What that means in the context of a domain, if it's integrating into a IAM solution, is out of scope. And so that is why I sort of looked at OpenID Connect as a standard way to plug in authenticators. And if we extend that profile, we can create that integration for KeyCloak.
So that makes sense to me, and I think what it does, my takeaway is if you look at that center, the OP, the verifier piece, which again to the RP looks like an OP, but otherwise it's a standard verifier, right? To buy us from a SSI architecture, right?
Yep.
So I'm thinking of it as sort of there's two strengths of that option there, and that this is what we were whiteboarding yesterday. There is exactly what's here, which is it's capable of speaking in both directions, right? And understanding OpenID on one side and DIDCOM and verifiable credentials on the other. But there's this simplified version in which it's all it does is SIOP. So as an OP, it's like, oh, okay, I take that. I can respond to SIOP, OpenID request with SIOP response. I can act as a self-issue identity provider, even though I've actually got a lot more capability than that. I think that capability is needed in other situations. It's not what you need here with KeyCloak, where you want that, you know, what you're building for KeyCloak is this whole full adaptable system. But really, it's for systems that don't have that capability to build that adapter, but they already speak OpenID. What you're enabling is edge agents to actually provide that OpenID response. You're enabling wallets to respond. If their edge agent is smart enough to recognize an OpenID request, they can talk OpenID with the SIOP protocol to anything that's asking them to authenticate that way, but they can do the full DIDCOM verifiable credential thing to any true verifier. Does that make sense, Tobias?
Yeah, that's totally correct. So the other way, Stephen, to achieve this integration would be to extend KeyCloak to be able to create SIOP requests and responses However, you would, that integration would require, in my eyes, much heavier modification of KeyCloak, essentially probably a custom authentication SPI, they call them. And then you would have to do that in other IAM solutions. Whereas in this implementation, you create a provider that has a couple of extended profile versions. And the way that you configure it in KeyCloak is you should be able to just select OpenID can provider, point it at its metadata URL and token URL and allow it to use these extended scopes. And the rest of that complexity is hidden. And so that's what we were trying to achieve based on the proposal, was a lightweight way of doing it. But absolutely, if you did want KeyCloak to issue SAOP directly, then you would collapse these two, but you would have much, much more detailed modification of KeyCloak required in my eyes. And then for any other IAM solution, you would have to do the same.
Yeah, exactly.
I just wanted to say that I looked at doing OpenID Connect in a different context a while back and essentially came to this same design. So I feel very cheerful to find that some other smart people ended up thinking about the problem in a way that made sense to me before. And so I'm super excited to have you build this. I feel a little bit more dissonance about the SIOP approach. I think it's right in the limited form that it's being used today. But as Drummond has said, if it starts trying to be used for too many things, I think that would be a mistake. And I think, Tobias, you're aligned with that too. So I hope that both of the efforts succeed, but I hope that the SIOP one doesn't get too ambitious. It just sticks with the charter that it already has.
Yeah, I want to reinforce the same thing. In fact, as you look at it, and I've square what the whiteboarding that we were doing and what we're looking at here, and you look at the RP on the far left, you can actually just really see it really easy. Either it's dealing with a cloud agent that's just basically smart and it can obviously talk to any edge agent on the right, or you're saying, oh, we're going to dumb everything down and take out the middle. And the RP is just going to be talking to that edge agent, but the edge agent's got to be able to talk SIOP then, because that's like the only thing that's going to work, right? And as soon as you look at it that way, it's like obvious that you're going to get a lot less functionality if you take out, you know, the whole cloud agent and all of its intelligence and components and everything, right? And again, the good news is, at least among the folks that were part of that conversation yesterday, everyone gets that. I think we're all agreeing that it's just it's a short-term thing. I will point out the advantages. Anything that is OpenID enabled today, right? Any system that says I will take, I speak SIOP, I will take a self-issued identity token, could talk to any edge agent that can do that, right? So it's not a minor, and I'm not saying they're huge, there's tons and tons of that stuff out there, but there are a lot of systems, and there are certainly folks, I can certainly say that Microsoft is one of them that wants to make sure that all the systems they've enabled to do that could talk to that edge agent under SIOP. It's sort of an immediate lift that we could get. So probably enough. I know we've drilled this to death, but it's been very helpful, Tobias. Thank you.
Good stuff. I would highlight that Robert Mitwicki posted Oliver his Terrible. Article on Medium. Terrible, yeah. On Medium about what is going on with the SIOP and what Diff is talking about.
Sorry, can you guys still hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Tobias.
Okay, cool. Sorry, my laptop just froze up, so I was just making sure that something hadn't changed. So that's really the nuts and bolts of this implementation. There are, so as I sort of said, you the OpenID Connect provider, the only thing it needs to support other than this extended scope and this additional query parameter is it needs to support, and the implementation I've done, there's multiple ways you can achieve this, is essentially a management API that allows a relying party to configure with the OpenID Connect provider a list of different types of verifiable credential authentication challenges, basically. So each time you create one of these, the idea is you would expose an API that would allow the relying party to create a verifiable presentation configuration. So they might create one for prove you're a lawyer, might one prove you're over 18, prove you a citizen of Canada, and you can create different configurations, and you use the IDs of those configurations and you reference them in your OpenID Connect request to select which type of authentication you want the OpenID Connect provider to conduct for you. And that is what this management API enables. And then essentially the output of all this authentication, as I said, because it's standard, the output of standard OpenID Connect is an ID token. In this case, it's exactly the same. What it will do is any claims that are disclosed in the verifiable presentation from the identity wallet will be flattened as claims into the identity token. And the only sticking point is the subject field of the identity token. And this here, because when you authenticate with an OpenID Connect provider under the OpenID Connect spec, the subject field needs to be locally unique to the provider. And so because you're doing verifiable credential authentication, and especially if you're doing a ZKP-based disclosure, and we don't have any correlation baked into that kind of disclosure, essentially the relying party is going to have to nominate which field it would like the OpenID Connect provider, to put as that subject field so it can have consistent cross-session correlation for auditing purposes or account purposes, depending on how that IAM. That's a total opt-in solution here. Obviously, when you define the configuration, you can set the subject identifier. If you do not set it, it will generate a GUID in that field every single time, so you won't have cross-session correlation. But if you do want to be able to identify the same user logging in multiple times, then you nominate a field that you, as the relying party, know will be the same based on the same authentication and repeat presentations. Does that make sense to others on this call?
Can that be any attribute or anything? I'm trying to figure out where that has to come from.
So you nominate a field in the verifiable credential disclosure. So if you nominate the first name and there's two Bobs, then you're not going to get uniqueness. So it relies on the relying party when they create the verifiable credential configuration, deciding which field they know is unique. This might come from a relationship to the credentials they're requesting and what they know them to be from the issuers, the original issuers. So they have to make that decision, because we can't, the OpenID Connect provider, the only way it could concoct uniqueness reliably is generating a GUID, but then it wouldn't allow you to identify the same authentication or the same person in multiple sessions, if that makes sense. So for example, I give the example here that if I created a verifiable presentation request configuration that asks for the email and first name of somebody from a known issuer, and then I said in the configuration that the subject identifier equals email from the attribute disclosure, then that is what will populate the subject field. If I left that blank, this would be a random GUID. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I get it. Yeah. So it could be the credential ID
Correct. So what it does is it forces the relying party to have a little bit more knowledge about the credentials it's requesting, because of how this ecosystem shifts and the responsibilities shift, that's just the nuance that changes in this profile.
Hey, Tobias, are you thinking this is an ephemeral proof request, proof process, presentation process?
Yes. So it just uses the services decorator.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was just confirming that there isn't a shared DID that would be used because it actually, no, that makes no sense at all. So go ahead. Go ahead, Daniel.
I wanted to ask about, just a minute, my stupid phone thing. I wanted to ask about whether self-attested data could be incorporated into this process. So could a user prove that they have a particular email, but, you know, have the subject field be populated with their, favorite gamer handle that they self-attested instead, something like that.
Absolutely. I think if the requested attributes didn't have restrictions and someone wanted to put self-attested attributes there, and if I requested an attribute like your gamer handle and I didn't put any restrictions on it and I nominated that gamer handle as the subject identifier, then that would appear there.
Okay.
So the relying party still has to be in control of what they want nominated as a subject identifier. I don't think it works if you shift that responsibility to the other side, but self-attested data would absolutely be supported in this model.
Okay. And then just another thing to maybe, I'm going to maybe go open an issue about this in the presentation protocol RFC, but I think we need to make it clear when you're doing a proof request to somebody that you intend to turn around and give the data to a third party.
Yep.
I don't think that'd be hard. I just don't think we're doing that right now.
Yep. I think that's a nuance worth highlighting for sure. Absolutely.
Hey, Daniel, that kind of, I'm not saying that's wrong, but that kind of feels like the terms of use idea in the verifiable credentials data model. Would you want to piggyback off of that and say, like, this data will be reused or is allowed to be reused in the following context or relayed to these parties? Like, would you want a proof of consent about that?
In the verifiable credentials working group, the terms of use that they focused on most heavily was terms of use from the issuer.
Right.
But what you're talking about is terms of use from the prover.
Right.
But of course, both are relevant. I guess the main thing I want to distinguish here is that the proof should be either repudiable or not repudiable. But maybe that's not enough of an maybe that's not enough precision. If Alice has to prove to the OpenID Connect provider that her email address is X, and the provider says, "By the way, I need it to be non-repudiable," that tells Alice that it could be shared. But it's not, I guess the relying party's not trying to share proof. They're just trying to share information.
Yeah, so, that's absolutely right. Because there's a trust relationship with them. Because essentially, you know, like if the OpenID Connect provider, as you pointed out at the start, was malicious, they could manufacture this ID token. But that's the same for any OpenID Connect provider. What you were rightfully asking them to, and what I'll also actually point out here is there's actually a further attribute in this ID token which references the ID of the presentation request. So that's like an attestation from the OpenID Connect provider that I did introduce them to the user in the following way. I think it is absolutely worth noting that the disclosure isn't being relayed in its full form. Because we want the disclosure back to the relying party to be a standard ID token. So I didn't want to modify it too heavily to have the proof of each attribute, because most integrating relying parties aren't going to understand those components of an ID token anyway.
Yeah.
if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we should call it here. This has taken, I think it's been useful, and I hope people got value out of it, that we're talking as much. But I think we can probably move on from this one, if that's okay. Any final comments from anyone?
No, it's been super helpful. Thank you, Tobias.
Cool, no worries. Thanks, guys.
Indeed. Thanks, Tobias. All right. The second part we'll do for the last 20 minutes or so. Looks like we're not going to have trouble filling our time. I was going to do, let me move this screen up. And I just, in order to lead the discussion, I don't have a lot on this, but I did want to lead the discussion and provide a bit of structure around it. So I will go to that to do. Priorities. I don't even think I spelled it right, did I? How about that? Priorities. What we wanted to do here was just talk through a bit about why it matters, what we're choosing on, what I wanted to get some feedback from people on what drives their priorities and what they're thinking. Take a look in particular at some RFCs that are sitting in proposed. And I sort of put a list in a spreadsheet just to sort of show people how many, it's easy to see how many are in proposed and sort of get a little bit of a classification and maybe some volunteers to facilitate a couple of RFCs to move them forward and get them over the line if that's appropriate. And then there's also some issues that are out there which are kind of interesting and I want to draw people's attention to those. So that's sort of what I was after. I think the important part of it, again, this is more discussion than me, you know, explaining it. These are just things that I was coming up with, but it can freeze implementers if we aren't moving on the RFCs. I've got an echo from someone. Hopefully that's resolved. Freezes implementers, kind of forces them to make unilateral decisions. If we don't know where implementers are, we get, you know, sort of evolution difficulties, version management becomes a problem. And it basically is a technical debt versus moving forward. We've got, for example, a 0.1 of credential management in place and credential issuance and credential presentation in place. We're moving towards 1.0 and sort of how we transition that and what we leave is kind of challenging. Lowers the overall quality of information. There's a lot of...
I'm not saying I'll get world record in 10 minutes, but do I get 10 minutes?
Hang on.
No. I think I'm going to go...
Hey, Stephen, could
there
you...
There we go.
Stephen, could you restate what is the thing that has these effects? What is lowering the quality and freezing implementers and barriers to entry?
The fact that we've got so much stuff in process and not decisions being made, that's what I'm thinking is there's a bunch of things that if we aren't getting decisions made, it sort of has these effects. You know, if a bunch of things, if a pile of issues get in, I was thinking more issues in this point of the average quality of information. If we've got many issues that aren't getting resolved, that somebody just raises one day and then doesn't do anything about, then we've got all these issues to look at, and overall the average quality goes down because the gems that are in there are hard to find. So this is just ideas on why we want to move forward on things, prioritizing.
So are you advocating that the community have a collective priority? Because I think part of the phenomenon here is that, you know, everybody has their own priorities.
Yes. And that's actually what I was wondering here. What do we think are the important, at this point in where we are with Aries, what do we think are the important things that are driving it? These are a couple of things that I thought of. People can look at those. Cross-cutting issues, you know, you and George and Troy have been talking about an Aries namespace, a special Aries did that is that provides the namespace separation of protocols. That's something that's cross-cutting that if we get right now, we don't have to redo when the time comes later. And the counter to that is, are we over-engineering things? Are we doing too much, trying to do too much to anticipating problems? So that's the balance there. Business drivers, I think, is something you mentioned. What are people working on? What live applications are coming on board? What demonstrations? And then just interoperability and independence, being able to define enough interoperability so people can proceed independently. So we can get a test suite done and we know that the message format can be tested with that, so everyone can work independently. These are the things we want to do for sort of driving the priorities. Are there other things that people think would push things to the top of the list other than these?
Well, I think these are good things to recognize, but I'm a little bit hesitant. I'm not down but I'm a little bit hesitant about engaging strongly on trying to align on community priorities. Part of an open source community is everybody can have their own, and whoever actually commits to work gets to kind of drive whatever the priorities are that matter to them. So I don't want to make strong commitments to the concept that we all have to agree on the right priorities.
No, and the reason I raised this was more to say these are the things you should be thinking about as we move into the next step, which is, you know, here's the list of proposed RFCs we've got that are sitting in proposed, but are not in accepted. And my claim is that there's, if we think about them from those previous, you know, sort of motivations, people will have motivations to move these ahead. And what I'm trying to get is from the community, which ones do we think are the most important, and see who wants to move some things forward, or is it okay for them just to sit in proposed for longer?
So my take on this has always been it's the author who drives the priority. So if an author puts it in proposed and then immediately proposes to move it to accepted status because they believe they spent a lot of time proposing it, you know, that's acceptable. We may reject it, but the priority of the work comes from the driver of people proposing it.
Okay.
Well, does that make sense? So I just have a question, you know, because I'm newer to this and I've written a few proposals, but I've kind of stalled because I don't know what to do next. Once it's been submitted to proposal, the only thing I've kind of heard is just drum up support for it.
Yeah, and so like if you, my thinking on it,
I have demos of how it could work and things like that, but you know, sometimes the concepts I propose, not a whole lot of people get it unless I do a demo. So, I mean, is that the best course of action? Or is there another thing I should be doing? And hopefully I'm not the only one that feels that way. So
yeah.
I just want a better, clearer path forward.
Yeah, I mean, I looked at these that, I thought as a community, we should be looking at things that ought to be sort of transitioned directly to accepted because they've been there long enough. And again, I go completely with Kyle on that, which is, you know, there's an author or at least a facilitator who's looked at this long enough and said, wow, this is ready. We should move it forward. There's a bunch that are in the middle of those, and we want, as a community, we want more insight onto it. So that's what you're talking about. Michael, I think, which is getting people to look at them and raising the profile, which, again, I don't know other ways than to raise the profile. As Daniel said, this is a community that, and we move forward as a community. There's probably some that we should just leave to proceed organically. There's some that are sort of advanced and nobody's hitting them, and we could let them sit for a while. I can, you know, there's things like overlays, which is in there. But there's not much we can do until later when, and I just picked that one randomly, but until we're further with rich schemas and have something we can do with it and we've got people ready to build things with it, there's probably not much we can do with that. And then maybe there's some that need to be culled from it, die on the vine, and the author should say, you know what, this no longer makes sense and we should have this one eliminated from the RFC list. I'm not sure what the ratio of those are between those. I did a quick spreadsheet. Let me just drag this over here. Presumably you could see that, and there's sort of, if I get rid of the blanks, there's sort of these set. I'm not sure how many there are there, but that are, if you look at these, somewhat are kind of surprising. They're sitting in proposed, and so we've got to figure out who the author is and can we move them forward. Some of them, issue credential, present proof, we're very near to be able to move them forward, and I think there's good discussion going on, so those are there. But things like, you know, decorators, should they be sitting in proposed? What are the thoughts of how to get, you know, basic message, get that moved into an accepted? Is it just, is it just the author goes in and bumps the status?
So it's interesting that you're bringing this up, Stephen, because on a call, I don't know, several weeks ago, I said, I'm going to be proposing that we move some of these to an accepted status. And then I never did it, which shows what a hypocrite I am. I just never got around to it, even though I was sensing the need to, you know, to make this progress happen. You're doing such a better job of asking the question or doing something about it than I am. I think on some of these, there is some issue that's preventing it. So I'll just pick the case of decorators. I think all the thinking in the decorators RFC is good thinking and has been implemented, except there's one issue that we haven't fully resolved to our satisfaction, which is a versioning question. How do you version decorators? There's been a discussion about that in issues, but we never got to closure. And so I just kind of left that sitting thinking, yeah, we need to do something about that. But right now it doesn't really matter. So that was probably laziness on my part. That's the real reason it's sitting there.
I would never associate you and laziness, and especially to do with this RFC repo. So let's just leave that thought aside. But yeah, that's interesting.
Can I add something?
Perception on those. Yeah, go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, so since you mentioned overlays, one of the thing which I think it was mentioned during those questions that a lot of people don't know what to do with those. Like you see the list of the proposed RFCs, and you don't know actually what is happening around it. So for example, overlays, it's pretty, you know, pretty big topic, and actually we are working on implementing that in a real use case for pharma companies. And of course, it will be nice to be able to update people about the progress, what is happening around those RFCs, that there is a work going on, that there is discussions, that there is some kind of progress. You know, the whole semantic working group call is, you know, touching on those topics and trying to update there, but no one can actually see it through the RFC. So there is no way to actually provide an update on those and show to people what is happening. So maybe we could think about like being able to provide some kind of progress. What is happening there? Who is working on it? And where I can check the progress and how I can contribute? Because this is one of the key points for open source ecosystem, that you specify how people can contribute on that specific topic, what they can do, right?
Building so on that, there's a status block in every RFC, and we could go in and say, in the status block, provide a link to a meeting page or something like that where you can learn more, or identify a chat channel where people hang out who talk about it. That would be a really good improvement, I think.
Yeah. That's good for start. I agree.
I mean, one thing as well I've been thinking about is maybe we should add another, either a section called implementations or just a line within this status section saying implementations, and people can put notes in those as well. Do you think it needs, is status note enough for that, Daniel, do you think?
Well, right now, the set of implementations that we might want to mention is probably, a small number, like 1 to 3 or 4 or 5 things for a given RFC. But hopefully in a year, we have a list of 20 implementations, and then it gets more.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it gets more reasonable to have a separate section about it, I think.
Yeah.
Another thing is that what was mentioned, that the author should kind of drive the whole initiative behind it, right? So he should have possibility to update the document and specify what happened so far, and adding those implementations, showing that actually community is working on it, right? Some kind of discussion, and so on. Because the assumption is that to move it from proposed to accepted, you need to incubate it within the community and that have the agreement within the community, right? How you prove that the agreement was in place, right? There are some chats, there are some meetings. So it would be nice to put everything in one place. So someone who will review the item to move to the different status, that he will have something to review actually, right? Because people are not able to track every single RFC, what is happening within the community.
So with that in mind, I think one of the things that we have to remember is, if we propose it for accepted status and you don't get your comments in before then, you just kind of have to live with it. You have to propose a new variation. It sounds wrong to say it that way, but I think it's the only way that we can actually force prioritization is through the PR process. And if you don't make a comment within the 2 weeks of the proposed period or however long we set, then that is the other option, is you go and take a lot of the accepted status stuff and propose a new idea. And so this creates a natural deprecation and upgrade process, like we've been talking about with the I believe it was the credential issuance stuff. Or no, the did exchange and connection stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking right now that we ought to do at least the following things. Number one, we ought to formalize something with better details in the status section of an RFC, and or add an implementation section so we can track that stuff. Maybe both, I think is what I'm liking the best. And number two, we ought to take some of the RFCs that have kind of been lingering but probably shouldn't, and move them to have a PR that changes their status to be accepted, and then the PR gives the community a chance to weigh in and raise concerns if they have them. And if the PR sits for 2 weeks without strong pushback, then we know that the community is happy with it and it becomes accepted. And if there is strong pushback, then we just, work through it.
Okay. Can I propose one more thing? What about adding a status between proposed and accepted called implemented that lets, I think it sort of talks to what Michael said, kind of what I've talked about recently, and what Robert mentioned, which is that the author has moved forward and done things and wants to highlight that, oh, we've created things and, we'd like others to move forward with it, as opposed to jumping direct from proposed to accepted. Would that be a reasonable... What's that?
Isn't the adopted status after approval? Because there is a proposed, approved, and then there is adopted. And basically this is what it says, is that there is already implementation in place. So it's like after...
Well, the difference is that one party can implement something. That doesn't
exactly
the whole community is implementing it and accepting it.
Yes. Yes. This would still be just a progression from proposed. The community has, somebody in the community has proposed it. They've gone further and implemented something, and but the community is not, you know, not made a lot of, shown a lot of interest in accepting it. And I don't think that, my worry would be just, you know, if we just start accepting a bunch, that there won't be enough interest in the community to do that. That's why I'm kind of liking the idea of having a midway, the middle one. But I'm not forcing it, but I think it would be interesting.
I like that concept, as long as we accept breaking changes at that point. Because I don't want to... okay, sounds good.
Troy, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I like that too. I do worry if we get too far down the accepted road without enough use cases implemented, and then say it's going to be hard to change things, that might not be a good outcome. But if there's this intermediate stage, that might be a good way to do that.
For the things that are not feature oriented, that are more conceptual, I think the implemented status is a little bit trickier. Like if you think about the RFC about DIDCOM, yes, there are people implementing DIDCOM, but you can't just point to something and say, there, that's the DIDCOM implementation. It's like manifested in a lot of places. So maybe we create that extra status, but we are a little bit soft about whether it has to be used for things that aren't features. Something like that.
I don't think any of these have to be used at all. I mean, somebody puts a PR that says, hey, I want to move to adopted. It's been sitting in proposed, but you know what? We've done a bunch of things. I think it should be marked as adopted. That should be a discussion. And so I'm fine with people jumping over the steps. I think that's what the PR process is for. But I think this would allow us to move things a little further without having to get to that community accepted.
Yeah, I would almost say too that in past experience you should have an implementation before you get to accepted status. Like we shouldn't be taking seriously proposed statuses jumping directly to adopted, because if nobody's implemented, have we learned anything?
Yep. I use that as a straw man. Just saying that the PR process can drive it. And I could agree completely with Daniel that, you know, on the concept side, you pretty much have to get to it. I don't know. Anyway, there's different examples for different things. And I think the PR process allows for that.
Yeah. I was actually just thinking about this too. So one of the things that this PR process is built for is standardization, which works very well for core concepts. Which is pretty much the only thing we're working on right now. But what happens when somebody brings in their, very specific niche protocol? Are we handling that in the same way and expecting everybody to adopt it? Or, these are the things that I've been thinking about that I just haven't found good answers to yet. And I wanted to bring in that discussion that I promised last week and haven't got around to yet.
Well, if something is not as widely applicable, but someone feels very strongly about it and they want it signed off to say, hey, if we're going to do this, whatever it is, it should be done this way. It falls in the prioritization discussion like anything else. If they want to advance it forward, if there are not a lot of folks to look at it and actually say that's important enough to look at, that's a different problem. And I don't,
I kind of think that anybody should be able to propose an RFC, and our standards for having an RFC in the repo in a proposed state should be relatively relaxed. For example, I have an idea about privacy-preserving discovery that I'm interested in writing up as an RFC, but I don't feel any need to try to get people to buy off on it or accept it. I just want to document it somewhere publicly and have a place to be able to refer to it for the next however long, could be 9 months, could be 3 years, until it becomes an issue that the community cares about. And between now and then, I'm content to let it sit as proposed status unless I get around to implementing it. I don't think I want to prune things out of the repo just because they're not standards track yet. I'd only prune them out if the author has decided it's now irrelevant to the community. But the thing that I would change is I wouldn't sort the list of things by status the way we're currently doing. I would sort it by, these are the adopted items, which have the highest level of commitment. These are the accepted items, which have the second highest level. And then everything else is kind of noise. And that should be at the bottom of the list.
Oh, okay. And my concern with that would be, that's where especially newcomers coming in get lost, because there's so much volume, and especially where there's stuff that's not relevant. So I get that. I also get the counter, which is, if we have too much of that, you can't find anything that's useful to you. So,
well, that's why that would be at the bottom of a list.
I think of adopted at the top, accepted, and then some status, if you're coming in and looking across that flat list of like, okay, well, what, you know, how mature is it, even if it's adopted, is like how widely adopted. But those are the kind of metadata we can only start adding once we, you know, get a little further down the road, I think.
Yeah. Well, the problem is I think the volume at proposed is just too high, and we need to, for where we are, I think there's a whole bunch in there that are, I shouldn't say too many, but some number that should be moved at least to accepted, certainly should be moved if we add this implemented, definitely should be moved to there, so that we can start to differentiate between those a little.
Should we on the front end of these calls each week, have a very short time where somebody can say, I'm going to move this to accepted this week, and as like a notification, and then that'll make it where it's like the author doesn't even have to do it. Like, cause I know you've been looking at this for a while, Stephen. I'd be fine if you went and took some of these ones that you listed out and said, hey, we're going to propose these be accepted this week. Even if they're things that Daniel has written, and I think that's fine.
I think that's a great idea. So I think maybe that the 2 week window starts when it gets announced on the call. The author should, or whoever makes the PR should, do the PR and plan on, you know, saying here's where it is and it should be accepted. And that should be part of this call. I think that's a great idea. So we've got a number of things in there. So that's awesome. I think the actions out of this are, I think we look at figuring out the one, I think we take a look at the status. I think we consider adding the implemented. I think I'll put that in as an issue, and I think let's try to move that forward. Encourage authors to go through, and if not, we encourage a facilitator to go through and look at the proposed ones and decide if there are some that can be moved forward. I think any that we move forward, we should talk about on this call, and that trigger a 2 week window. I think that's probably a good process that we could see about adopting. And
on that topic, I promised to have the Evernym team update the credential exchange ones. I think it's 36 and 37 to move it to accepted.
Yeah.
We didn't get that done, but we will get that done. I apologize for being late.
I did see there was a pull request that has the new drawings in, though, so people should be looking at those and checking to make sure they're ready.
Can I ask
all right.
Small request on the
PRs. Go ahead.
When you're making accepted status, put the deadline date so that everybody can prioritize based upon that date. Does that make sense?
Okay.
So when you're making the PR for accepted, say you make something today, for one of the ones that you proposed, like the connection and did exchange protocol, put in there 2 weeks from today as like a deadline date that we can prioritize.
Okay. So, all right, I'll take some actions item out of this. We are over time by 3 minutes, which is roughly where we started, so we're not doing too badly, but I think we should call this meeting. Anyone will continue the conversation. I'm trying to find, here we are. We didn't get to next week's call. I did have a side conversation. People might have seen that over chat to talk about the DIFF interop project. So I'm going to try to get Ruben to bring someone up here. And I hope we have some movement on some RFCs for next week. Anyone have a quick, if anyone has these other topics that are interested in talking about, please get in touch with myself or Sam Curran to schedule that for next week's call. And we are not going to get to open discussion this week because we're over already. That's the call for this week.
Sounds good.
Thanks all for attending.
Thanks, guys.
See ya.